Off the Ball Breakfast.
I've used Rory McIlroy's achievement as personal growth for myself. You can overcome adversity to lead your business in Q2.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Hello there, Owen here, and this is the 10th and final part of Diverted. Just a quick word to say thank you to everyone who has been listening throughout the series, who's given a positive ratings, who's got in touch with me, and who has shared it with their friends as well. The series, as you know by now, is not time sensitive whatsoever, so hopefully it's still going to be a worthwhile listen and a nice discovery for people for some time to come. This is the end of this particular journey. Just a heads up, there are going to be some callbacks to previous episodes and there will be some bad language. Diverted, part 10 of 10. I hope you enjoy. You and I, we've been through a lot together. And I think you've earned my complete honesty at this point. And as we enter what will hopefully be the final leg of this journey, I must admit, I am battling the hangover of a lifetime. I'm in the town of El Chalten, and given how tight my schedule has been, yesterday was my only opportunity to climb Mount Fitzroy. You know the mountain I'm talking about. Its silhouette forms the logo of the Patagonia clothing brand. It's been a bad couple of weeks here visibility-wise. Some tourists have hung around for days on end, climbing halfway on multiple mornings, only to turn back due to a lack of visibility. But I, on my one day, have managed to summit in crystal clear conditions. My luck in Argentina has officially turned. And when a crew of Irish visitors get in touch to see if I'm around that night for a pint, it is an easy yes. One celebratory Fernet turns into many, many celebratory Fernets. And now on this hazy Sunday morning, the only thing I can taste and smell is Fernet. And the only thing I can feel is pain. The 1,000 kilometres remaining until Ushuaia feels like a bit of an ordeal. But my fellow Irish people, my fellow purveyors of Fernet, offer to drive me in their rental car for as long as it's useful to me. Liam and Christine in the front, Paul and Brendan and myself in the back. The most hungover car that has ever trundled through Patagonia. We travel south back to El Calafate and they leave me off at a YPF petrol station on the edge of town. Extremely sound people. A gift from the gods on a day like this. I muster the strength to stick the tum out, and every 2 to 3 minutes feels like an eternity. But I'll take that, because 2 to 3 minutes is all it takes for a car to pull in. This is Valentin, a retired police officer. And Valentin seems as surprised as me that I hit the jackpot after only a couple of minutes.
¿Hace cuánto estás haciendo dedo?
2 or 3 minutos.
Pero what the... Está iluminado.
It's gone 2 o'clock in the afternoon at this stage, and I'm feeling greedy. I inquire if making Ushuaia will be possible tonight.
Es posible ir a Ushuaia hoy, or es no posible, necesito ir a mañana.
Y ahora la noche no va nadie por el tema de la aduana.
It's okay, sí.
It's a Sunday and a ferry will be required to get across to Tierra del Fuego, so it's not looking good. But I've matured as a hitchhiker over the last couple of thousand kilometres, and I will settle for Rio Gallegos tonight, which is where Valentin is going. He asks if I have a tent.
¿Y la noche que haces carpa?
No, no tengo carpa.
Which gives a nice little injection of PTSD. And I mention Gobernador Gregores.
The Gobernador Gregores?
Just to ramp up the anxiety for myself.
Escucho todo tipo de música.
And he's big into his music. He loves Queen.
Me gusta mucho Queen.
Queen.
And his favorite song is...
Mi favorita, la Rapsodia Bohemia.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Okay. Rapsodia Bohemia.
And I'm a big fan of the fact that they have a Spanish title for the song.
Eso es música del altiplano.
¿Dónde?
Se escucha mucho en Jujuy, así.
Ah, sí.
He introduces me to some music from Jujuy. Jujuy is ages away from here, up in the extreme northwest, near the border with Bolivia. And anyone who has listened to episode 3 will know that all music in and around Bolivia slaps. And Natalia Lafourcade comes on the radio, the soundtrack to anyone who has ever visited Latin America. We drive away from the beauty of El Calafate and Lago Argentino. We drive along Route 40 and its barren vista southeast. And when we drive through the small settlement of Esperanza, Route 40 becomes Route 5. I realise then that I've said goodbye to Route 40 for the final time. My conclusion is that it is indeed a cruel, cruel passage of tarmac, one that takes on many different forms of cruelty. The bustling and balmy nature of the road in Bariloche, utterly in contrast with the desolate, frigid environment in, say, Bajo Caracoles. But it's the same road. It's one that I won't miss, one that I won't forget. And I'll get its signpost tattooed on my ankle. For the third time, I go through the checkpoint heading into Rio Gallegos.
Buenas tardes. Calafate. Gallego. Mi mochila y la del.
And pass the Jesus Loves You sign again. I say goodbye to Valentin, and I stroll around the town of Rio Gallegos. Some of the streets are turned into rubble. Presumably there is work going on, but it's a Sunday, so nothing is happening. There's a pub called Belfast Pub. The door opens and I walk in, but the lights are off and there's no one here. I'm a little creeped out, so I find a cheap hotel and call it a night.
This could be the final day of the hitchhiking.
It's 7:30 on Monday morning.
I think it's like an 8-hour journey or something like that, all the way down to Ushuaia, not including the border check, so probably looking at about 10, maybe even 12 hours.
Today, I need to get a lift down the remainder of Route 3. I need to check out of Argentina, check into Chile, get a ferry across to Tierra del Fuego, cross back out of Chile, cross back into Argentina, and then get down to Ushuaia. I walk south to find a spot on the side of the road going out of town. If you were to turn east here and sail out into the Atlantic, you would eventually land on Las Malvinas, or the Falklands. There's a military base on the outskirts of Rio Gallegos. Their orchestra is on fire this morning. A couple of hours pass by. I stand and try to thumb a lift for a while. But then I get cold, put the bags back on, and keep walking south while thumbing. Shortly after 10 a.m, a man named Fernando picks me up.
Después Buenos Aires, creo Rosario, Mendoza, Cordoba, Salta.
Ah, yo soy Santa Fe.
Sí. Oh, sí?
He's from Santa Fe province, home to the city of Rosario. Fernando isn't going to be able to take me to the border.
Te tenés que registrar con la policía, para.
Sí.
And there is a police checkpoint coming up in a little bit down the road anyway. He says he's going to have to leave me here.
Okay, sí.
Y te van a registrar y después ya está.
Ah, sí, necesito ir a la oficina.
Claro.
And that I need to go inside to speak to the police.
Hasta luego, Fernando.
Registrate ahí con la policía, te van a anotar y después ya está, puedes hacer dedo acá y te van a anotar.
Okay, sí.
I say goodbye to Fernando.
Hola, buenos días.
Buenos días.
¿Cómo estás?
Bien. ¿Pasa por?
taxi, and the police write my details down into a notebook.
Ushuaia?
Sí, exactamente.
They let me continue. I stand beside a big signpost that conveniently has Ushuaia's distance written on it. 586 kilometres to go. I wait far enough away from the police checkpoint to not throw potential drivers off the scent, and the time ticks by. My PTSD is sent into overdrive when a car carrying trailer drives past. I do not stick the thumb out. I've caused their kind enough trauma this past week. Then something extraordinary happens. A truck pulls in for me, and the driver is not Chilean. It is actually an Argentinian truck driver.
¿Qué es tu nombre?
Sebastián.
His name is Sebastian.
¿Cómo se
llama? Mi nombre Owen.
¿Cómo?
Owen.
Owen.
Owen, sí.
And he's also from Santa Fe.
¿Cuánto tiempo?
De Santa Cruz hoy, tres días.
Wow.
De viaje.
Due to his experiences of how he is treated at the border, Sebastian is not a fan of Chile or of Chileans.
Los problemas son Chile, porque son malos con argentinos. No solamente nosotros, capaz que a vos también.
Sí, ¿por qué?
Porque son así, son malos. Acá en Argentina decimos forro.
We close in on the Chilean border, and he explains what's going to happen.
Llegamos a la frontera, vos te bajás con el bolso.
Sí, antes la frontera.
Y hace frontera. Y a ellos le decís que sos caminante, no le digas que andas dedo.
Sí.
He is going to drop me off before we get there. I am going to walk to the border and tell the border guards that I'm walking through the border today. And he will tell the border guards that he has no passengers. It might be needlessly complicated, but I meet back up with Sebastian after the border check and get back in his truck. He drives into Chilean territory for a few minutes, and then he points at a plastic bag at my feet. All the rubbish he's accumulated has been kept in here, from paper cups to napkins. I pass him the bag. He checks his wing mirrors. And then he flings the bag out the window and into the Chilean wilderness. He leaves at a big laugh. This man really despises this country. He turns up the radio when a song comes on that he likes. Sebastian, not a fan of Chileans, but boy does he love Miley Cyrus. We continue on to Punta Delgada to cross the Magellan Strait. The very south of the continent is a collection of islands, Tierra del Fuego. And to get to Isla Grande de Tierra del Fuego, we drive onto a ferry. When we're parked up in the boat, Sebastian pulls out a drawer full of food. The spread is incredible. First course, a circular slice of cheesy pizza with an olive on top. Then it's a filled ring donut, chocolate on top, but the ring-shaped pastry actually has a dulce de leche filling. Next is another pastry, a slightly tubular entity with icing on top. I'm not sure what it's called. And then lastly, out comes the ham and cheese and bread sandwiches for dessert. I found out that the key to hitchhiking is not just patience, it's also the physical capability to inject 400 different types of sugary carbs into yourself on a daily basis. The ferry is a short ride, and we roll onto Tierra del Fuego. In English, Land of Fire. The story goes that Ferdinand Magellan christened it thus, after he observed the many bonfires lit by indigenous populations along the coast during his expedition of 1520. 2 hours in the truck and we're nearly back in Argentina. Sebastian almost hits a vicuña. But it survives. We cross through the border checks again. Sebastian speed walks ahead of me on the Chilean side so to not look like he's with me. And then we're about an hour and a half from Rio Grande, which is as far as he will take me today. Natalia Lafourcade once again is the soundtrack, travelling southeast.
Hey.
I get out at a YPF petrol station along Route 3, and Sebastian turns back towards the town centre of Rio Grande, where he will stay tonight. With 205 kilometres to Ushuaia, the finish line is nearly in sight. It's 5:30. A car stops, and they offer me a lift to a place called Tulhuin, and finally, I say no to an offer. I've never heard of the place, and it's going to get dark soon. I'd rather get trapped in a relatively big city like Rio Grande. A second car stops, and they also offer me a lift to Tulhuin. I say no again. Then a third car stops, and again, the offer is a drive to Tulhuin. This time, I ask the driver if there is any accommodation in Tulhuin. Should I get stuck there tonight? And he assures me that I'll be okay. I hop into the back, crammed in with a couple of other guys. The car is full of painters coming home from work in Rio Grande.
Somos de Tulhuin.
Sí.
Y vinimos a hacer un trabajo acá en Rio Grande. Hoy estamos haciendo trabajo de pintura.
Ah, sí.
They tell me that they're from Misiones, which is in the north of the country, a cool 45-hour drive from here. They say they do their drive home at Christmas. They pass around Mate, and everyone is wrapped up in their warmest clothes. It's beautiful down here, but easily 20 degrees colder than their home on any given day. They tell me that tax breaks were provided to people to come down and work in Tierra del Fuego, and that's why they're here. As it turns out, we drive past another hitchhiker. Sadly, no room, and I feel for the guy. We land in Tulhuin just coming up to 7 p.m, and I'm dropped at a YPF petrol station. I realise that there are no more YPF petrol stations between here and Ushuaia. This is the last one. I will not be getting the name of a petroleum company tattooed on me, just FYI. My destination is 103 kilometres away, and I've got about 1 hour of light left. I'm one lift away. I walk down to a bridge with a view of the lake and the last run of the southern Andes right in front of me. They're now snow-capped. Back in Bariloche at the start of this, the Andes were brown, burnt, sun-baked. That was where Mikhail picked me up and brought me to El Bolsón. From there, Julian, Paula, Cooney, Pedro, and Uruguayan festival goers featuring Mure the Dog got me to Ezquel. There was then Guillermo, Jorg from Chile, and two consecutive Walters who got me to Trelew. There was Samuel who let me drive his car along the Atlantic coast. And Gerardo, Martin, Gerardo 2.0, and the not particularly friendly Victor who got me back to the Andes. There was the infamous Ramon, and the couple who saved me from the land version of the ever-given blockage. There was Joaquin and Omar last Friday, Liam and Valentin yesterday. Today, Fernando, Sebastian, and the lads from Misiones have got me to within touching distance. 24 different drivers over 9 days. I turn to walk back towards the small town of Tulhuin, my thumb out, and car number 25 pulls in. Estefan is the driver, and his partner, Betty, is in the passenger seat. They're both going home from work, home being Ushuaia. They say they love living in Ushuaia. Betty says she loves the mountains and the water, and they pull in at a mirador.
No, Ushuaia.
They go for a smoke and they walk hand in hand up to a little platform. It overlooks a lake called Lago Escondido, which is hugged by the hills. In the distance lies the much larger Lago Fagnaro. It's at that stage where you can barely see, but this little pocket is just stunning. Estefan is wearing Nissan branded overalls. Betty is wearing a green apron with a shamrock on it. Fittingly, we're 3 days away from St. Patrick's Day. We get back in the car. and the road takes its final curve along the Beagle Channel and into the city of Ushuaia. If we accept that the Chilean settlement of Puerto Williams, with a population of around 3,000 people, is indeed a city, then Ushuaia is the second most southerly city in the world. It's dark when we arrive, but we're finally landing. I don't really know what to do, so I go to a shop and I buy one singular can of beer. And I sit shivering on a bench, looking towards the last patch of land before Antarctica. This is where I'm supposed to say something profound and deliver to you the life lessons I've learned on this journey. I'm not sure there is much more to say, given you can already guess the lessons I've learned from some stupid logistical moments on my part. Inwardly, this moment is just pure satisfaction. There were at least 5 moments where I thought I'd just have to pack this whole thing in, so it feels good to have not done that and to have finished it. On a more outward-looking level, I try to find the common denominator between those that stopped to pick me up over the past fortnight. It feels like a broad range. There were truckers and students and painters and teachers and festival sesh heads, and I kind of realised then that it's probably easier to find the common denominator as to what those people do not represent. I'm not into cars, and honestly I could barely tell you the make of any vehicle that did stop. But I can tell you, many, many beautiful cars drove past. Many expensive rental cars drove past. Many, many rich people drove past. And their common denominator is that none of them stopped. The retired couple of Guillermo and Adriana on day 3 seemed to have a bit of money, but that's the closest example I have. I seem to have been picked up by every demographic on these roads, from domestic workers to workers from other countries to tourists on a budget. There were, of course, hundreds and hundreds of vehicles driven by people of the same demographic who felt fear when they saw me and they drove past. But I've also realised that dozens more drove past because they looked down their nose at me. Or maybe that's the same thing as fear. There's a website called HitchWiki, where hitchhikers share their personal experiences of getting from A to B while thumbing lifts. One user says that from Bariloche they were able to get to Ushuaia in 4 days, but it is definitely doable in 3. I just want to say congratulations to that person. If we were defined by the efficiency with which we hitchhike, you are a much better person than I am. Mission accomplished. But there is one last story from Patagonia I want to bring you. You might remember in episode 5 as I drove with Walter to the town of Trelew, that we drove past the towns of Dolavon and Gaiman, towns with signage in the Welsh language. I promised that we would revisit the Welsh imprint on Patagonia. The problem with hitchhiking whilst trying to produce some content is that the hitchhiking sort of becomes all-consuming. There's no time for reading, for sending emails, or for doing any sort of research whatsoever. You've only really got time to be stressed out of your mind. It's a Saturday in the town of Trelew, and it's my only day in this part of Argentina. Tomorrow I need to leave to continue down Route 3. I've set up no interviews and have 0 contacts here. If I'm going to have a story to tell you, it's going to be done entirely through the old-fashioned method of doorstepping people. Thankfully, there is nothing subtle about the Welsh imprint in this part of the world. And I walk past a building in the middle of Trelew that is called the Association of Saint David, and it's got a big red dragon outside it. I figure we might have a lead. There is some sort of flea market happening in the Association of Saint David's headquarters today. I go up to the first table I see, and I meet the most helpful people of all time. They get straight on the phone, and they tell me that the director of the association has dropped everything to come and meet me.
Amazing. ¿Qué es su nombre?
Yo
Vicky.
Tu Vicky.
Vicky.
Vicky. Muchas gracias, Vicky, para ayuda. Y muy rápido también. Muchas gracias.
Así, yo soy así. Trabajo de eso.
While we're waiting, here's a quick rundown on what the crack is here. So, the story of the Welsh in Patagonia goes back to the 19th century. And I think it's important to remind ourselves of some of the grim context of this era of Argentina before anything else. So throughout the 1870s and 1880s, we had the Argentina military campaign called Conquest of the Desert. It was led by General Julio Argentino Roca. The Argentine government wanted to occupy these vast, lucrative territories of Patagonia. There was a strong indigenous resistance in these areas because, you know, they lived there. It would be an understatement to say that Roca's legacy has been called into question as a result of what happened during this conquest, which was barbaric and is referred to by many scholars who know this stuff inside out as a genocide. The Mapuche and other indigenous populations were crushed. Thousands were killed and thousands were captured, dehumanized as servants or prisoners. Instead of these tribes, the Argentine government wanted Europeans to come and populate the areas. Meanwhile, in Wales, there was an appetite for a Welsh colony. They figured that for the culture and the language to survive and thrive, it would be best to go to a place not dominated by the English language. Argentina offered substantial land along the Chubut River, and in 1865, 153 Welsh settlers arrived in Patagonia. Now, this was before the conquest of the desert came into full swing, and the Welsh did come into contact with the local indigenous population, the Tehuelches. There are accounts of suspicion and some violence, but eventually a cordial relationship between the two cultures is reported to have developed, to the point where the Welsh learned from the natives how best to survive on the sort of land that was pretty unfamiliar to them. The towns of Puerto Madryn, Rawson, Trelew, Gaiman, Dolavon, Esquel and Trevelin, all in the province of Chubut, still have a strong Welsh imprint to this day. It can be identified in things as obvious as the red dragon hanging outside businesses, and it can be identified when someone introduces themselves to you.
Hola.
Hello.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
¿Cómo estás? Bien. ¿Vas a pasar mi mamá a la oficina ahí de...?
Sí.
This Argentinian man speaking to me in Spanish, his name is Daniel Hughes.
Y porque era un lugar donde se podían instalar y mantener sus costumbres, su religión, el idioma.
Daniel's ancestors arrived from Wales in the 1880s, and he's telling me here that this is a place where they could settle and maintain their customs, their religion, the language, which was not allowed in Great Britain.
Que no se lo permitía en Gran Bretaña, o sea, en el Reino Unido.
With Daniel is another member of the St. David Association.
Croiso.
Croiso.
This is Astrid Rees, whose ancestors also arrived in the 1880s.
When Welsh came into Patagonia, it was so important to them to maintain their culture, their language, their religion, and their way of living life. And for us, it's still so important to maintain the same things, to be able to make our things, our culture, our language. We still practice Welsh, learn Welsh, kids, like my son, start learning Welsh. It's very important to maintain all the traditions. Mm-hmm. I would say that.
Can you explain to me the other cultural things, I guess, that you have to do or that the events that you engage in order to maintain a sense of Welshness?
Well, Welsh people are known in the world for singing,
yeah,
for praying, for singing and praying and at the same time. For celebrating the Eisteddfod, which is a festival that has all kinds of competitions of literature, poetry, singing, of course, dancing. It's very important to them. So we dance, we sing, we write poetry. We like to show every aspect of the arts, basically.
How good is your Welsh in terms of speaking it?
I speak Welsh, yeah, pretty fluently, yes.
Yeah, amazing. But what is the situation for most people here? Do people here, obviously Spanish is the first language.
Yes.
Is Welsh more widely spoken than English here?
In our community in particular, so the Welsh descendants, Yes, okay. There's more likely to speak Welsh than English. Mm-hmm. In my case, my family comes from England too, so we speak both. But mostly the Welsh people here speak Spanish and Welsh. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's a lot of families that raise their kids in both languages.
Okay.
At the same level, we would say. Their first language a lot of times is Welsh. And there's a lot of people, of Welsh people or Welsh descendants, that really like to play rugby, for example.
Of course.
Which is something very particular of Wales.
Yes. It wouldn't be a Welsh region without rugby.
Are
Welsh games, Wales games, do people gather to watch them here?
Yeah, we do. Well, I don't particularly,
sure.
But people do, especially in one of the traditional cafes we have in Trelew.
Oh, yeah?
Which is the Touring Club.
Okay.
They put a big screen and people watched every rugby game.
Mi amiga va a llamar al director del club.
Oh, sí?
Para que yo te dé el teléfono.
Se llama Paloma. Paloma Piu.
Mm-hmm.
Ella es de habla inglesa, ella habla inglés.
Paloma Piu.
Paloma Piu. Piu va con acento
acá. ¿Y dónde es Paloma? ¿Aquí?
Paloma es de, creo que es de Gaiman.
En Gaiman. Y habla inglés.
Habla inglés.
Okay.
Ella ya sabe que lo va a hacer.
Four kids. Okay. And I have to clean a date, but I say I clean tomorrow. good, I don't want to. This house is a, I don't know if Billy maybe don't say. This guy?
Yeah.
He's a more Welsh guy in...
The most Welsh guy in Gaiman?
Yeah, absolutely. His name is Billy Hughes.
Billy Hughes, wow. What a Welsh name.
I don't know if he's cute, but... We can...
Yeah.
I'm being driven around the town of Gaiman, 20 minutes out the road.
This dog, when he's hungry, I swear... He bites the car wheels.
Oh, he bites the car wheels.
And break.
Oh, no way.
I swear. It's like three or four people in Gaiman already complained about that dog. They broke the... I never see it.
And I think it's fair to say that Gaiman is the most Welsh of all the Welsh towns. There are red post boxes. There are red dragons on park benches. Red dragons on public bins.
This family is speaking Welsh.
Yeah.
There are tea houses where you can eat cake and crumpets. I am reliably informed, though, that the tea is Argentine tea and not imported from Britain.
Hola. This is where they always come to drink mate.
I'm in the car of Paloma Piu. She's a teacher.
This is Gualegamui.
Okay. That's your school?
Yep. This is the first college of Patagonia. High school. Yeah,
1998. Wow. There you go, 1906.
But it's nice.
That's crazy though, isn't it? Like, not only the first Welsh school, the first secondary school.
See, first.
Paloma is also a rugby fanatic and a member and coach of the local rugby club called Drake Goch, Welsh for Red Dragon.
Estos son los que menos se la bancan. ¿Todo bien? No fueron al partido.
She's filling a local in on what happened in the club's senior game earlier.
Perdieron, pero re piola jugaron. Iban ganando 18-17 y después se rompió, como siempre. Segundo tiempo, culpa del árbitro.
Drake Goch lost narrowly to local rivals Trelew.
Is he supposed to be playing in the game?
Yeah, no, he broke the ankle.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
The separation between these places, between Gaiman and Dolavon and Trelew, is there a rivalry between these little Welsh towns?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, Gaiman is the most Welsh town around here, yeah. But we have a rivalry with Dolavon because they are small like us.
Okay.
But, yeah, and with Trelew because, well, you know, Trelew is a Welsh name. It's Tre, it's town. Leo is Lewis Jones. Mm-hmm. This is Trelew. But, yeah, Gaiman is the most, it's the best one. Yeah.
Yeah, and would it be offensive to those other places to suggest that Gaiman is more Welsh? Is like being more Welsh like a badge of pride?
No, they know.
They know.
They know.
It's just a fact.
Yeah, it's a fact. It's no, it's no, yeah, it's a fact. They, some people in Trelew, they think, but no, no, it's a fact. Trelew, Gaiman is the, and Madryn too. Madryn have, Gaiman is more cozy because it's smaller, but in Madryn, like the Welsh people arrived to Madryn in the Mimosa.
The Mimosa was the ship that carried the first Welsh migrants to Patagonia.
And they, if you go to Madryn, you have, you can see the caves where the Welsh people live, where they arrive before come to here. And yeah, in Madryn is very Welshy too.
This rugby club is not something that your ancestors came and founded. This is a recent club. This is the work, the hard work of many Welsh Patagonians who have decided that their Welshness was so important that they needed to actually set up a rugby club that is called Dreig Gach.
Yeah, it's a new club, but in we have only 18 years, but in 1980, around 1990, one like 20 guys get together and say, we will play, and they play 1 year and made the name Dreig Gach.
Okay.
Because they were all Welsh and Irish, and they say, okay, we, and they make that, but they only play 1 year and no more. And in 2006, when we start again, the guys say, we have to name Dreig Gach as they name and as they feel, because we have to have a Welsh name. Mm-hmm. And what better than Red Dragon?
See, yes.
More Welsh than that, I think it's nothing.
So talk us through the club then, and kind of the importance of this club in the community of Gaiman.
In Argentina, the rugby is more like for, I don't know, now it's a little bit changing, but it's like for the people who, I don't know how to say, but
middle to high, upper class, yeah. Right?
And our club is very social. Mm-hmm. We have the, it's very cheap. Even if some guys can't pay, they play anyway. And the guys, when they start to play in, well, they start in 2006, they play in the first team, and in some point they play 1 year and they say, okay, if we want to have future, we have to stop playing. Mm-hmm. And take care of the kids and have like under 7, under 8, under 9, under 10. And that they start, they stop the first team, even they was like 26, 28 years old, they totally can play rugby, and they say, no more, we will do that, this for the kids, for the Gaiman. And they quit playing and they start training the kids, and now we have under 7, under 8, under 9, under 10. Or the youth, first team, and women team.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they literally disbanded the senior team to try and help coach.
Yeah, they stop. They say, okay, we have to hang the botines, the shoes, and we have to look the kids. And they quit, and they start to do that.
Is there like a sense that everybody here are more Argentinian fans or Wales fans? Like if they were playing each other in the morning, do you support Argentina? Do you support Wales? What's the situation there?
No, we support Argentina, yeah. But Welsh again, anyone Welsh, but Argentina Welsh, we go for Argentina. Sorry.
No, it's all. It's
actually, all. We've been in 8 of us, my friends, they do the club. We've been in Millennium watching Pumas Wales in 2016, and we stand and we sing the Argentina song. Mm-hmm. And after that we sit and we stand again and we sing the Welsh song, because we know, of course. And all the people are like, why are you singing the both song? And then we explain it.
Yeah.
All the people around us were like, why are you singing both songs? And yeah, it was amazing, but we cheer for Argentina.
Yeah, of course.
Ian Evans ag Alan Wynne-Jones. Mewn gêm rhyngwladol ym Mhatagonia.
You didn't necessarily need to go all the way to Wales either to see Wales and Alan Wynne-Jones, for example. They played right here in Patagonia, right?
Yeah, they played in 2007, 7 or 6, yeah, around that. I think it's the first game of Alan Wynne in his career, and yeah, it's amazing. They have all the coaches and managers and that come to here to Gaiman. No, the players too come to Gaiman to have a hospitality and have an asado.
Their facility here is shared with hockey, and they've got two pitches for rugby, one that's grass and another which is not very grassy at all.
You train on this field, the one with no grass. What's it like to play rugby on a field with no grass, I should say?
Hard. It's really hard. But the good thing is the boys training and the girls training there. And after that, when they go to the grass, like, chow, and they're really like a pillow. Yeah, absolutely.
As a teacher, Paloma is also witnessing firsthand a pretty amazing rebirth of the Welsh language here, over 12,000 kilometres away from Wales.
Why is it important to keep the Welsh culture alive for you?
For me, Paloma is my great-grandmother come from Wales, and I've been in Wales like four times. I love the culture, and I of course I'm Argentinian.
Sure.
But I love my Welsh heritage. Yeah. And I think for me, it's every time I travel to Wales, I have the most welcome, and they are really, really nice with me, and I love that. And I think it's the same for me that is for them. It's a strong connection that we have. I can't explain.
No, it makes sense. It's a family thing. Yeah. Everybody here who speaks Welsh and has a connection with Welsh, well, I assume everybody, or the vast majority of people, they have a literal blood connection to the country. Yeah. Like, is that the most important reason?
I think so. But these people here, they don't have
really
Welsh blood, and they speak in Welsh fluent, like really fluent, amazing.
So what is it to them, do you think? What do you think is motivating them to keep the Welsh culture alive?
I don't know, but I think it's all the context, Gaiman keep this atmosphere, and we love the stable and all the tea and that things, I think, keep alive the Welsh culture here. I think it's more contagious.
Contagious, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I don't know.
Yeah, it's almost as if like Welshness exists separately from Wales.
Yeah, I know. It's weird, but I don't know.
It's amazing. It's one of the most unique places I've ever been.
It's like normal for me. It's like I can't explain because I grow with this.
Sure.
So I have a Welsh in the school, I have Welsh in the high school. So for me, it's like, and changed a lot because when I was in school, I didn't study a lot of Welsh. But when I travel for the first time to Wales, I say I can't don't speak in Welsh. I have to learn, and I'm learning now. When I travel and I see the people in Wales feel the same things that we think. I think that make grow in me, but I don't know. Yeah.
One of the things that's impossible to ignore when you get to Patagonia is the amount of signs that say Las Malvinas son Argentinas. To many English speakers, the translation might read, the Falklands are Argentine. Although I'm reliably informed that to translate the word Malvinas to the F word is a grave offence down here, regardless of your first language. And I'm happy enough to go along with that.
Yeah, not only this part. This is in all Argentina, all yeah. Even in Iguazu and the really north, you have like signs sometimes like Malvinas are Argentinas, but... Yeah, I don't live the war, that war, but it's of course, it's a feeling there. And even now, the song, the best song of the Football World Cup, say the Malvinas.
Yes.
So it's in every one of us, like, very sentimental thing, the Malvinas, because we have here in people in Gaiman who was in the war.
Yeah.
They still live here, and they are parents of Maroi students, or they're still here, no?
And that's the really interesting thing, isn't it? That people from Gaiman, people from Tralee, people from Dolavon fought in that war.
Yeah.
With British heritage, essentially. Welsh heritage.
Yeah.
But British heritage against Great Britain.
Yeah, it's amazing that. If you think in that way, yeah, it's amazing. We hope the Patagonia was a separate country.
Yeah.
From Rio Colorado to South Another country, yeah, Patagonia country, yeah. We don't, well, sorry, but we don't. I think everyone in the country is against, or against, or, I don't know, Buenos Aires people, you know?
Sure.
Like, yeah, Buenos Aires, we say porteños, and sí. It's like, yeah, it's not like, but it happened here, happened in Mendoza, in the Salta, in the north. Like, if you see in Twitter, always is all the country against Buenos Aires.
Okay.
It's yeah. funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And when some from Buenos Aires come here, you can see, even if they don't speak, but you can see them. They are from Buenos Aires.
Yeah,
I don't know how, but you can see them. I have a power that I see. For example, I was in Germany, and I saw one guy. I say, that is from Buenos Aires.
Really?
And I like waiting, and he speak and. He was from Buenos Aires. Yeah, they're really like, yell a lot. Sorry.
No, that's a piece of advice to all the porteños out there. Learn some Welsh, and then you will blend into the crowd here, and you'll be fine. Exactly.
When I eventually arrive in Ushuaia a couple of weeks later, one of my most interesting exchanges is in a pub with a local who didn't seem to comprehend the idea that I'm from a country that isn't British. He takes me to task over the Malvinas, as I try to explain that, really, you're barking up the wrong tree if you're looking for someone to fight on this subject. Generally speaking, the pubs of Ushuaia are fascinating places. In one of the southernmost cities in the world, you've got people huddling around drinks in these places, many of them staff that are about to work on a boat to Antarctica, or have just returned from Antarctica. Due to my lack of aptitude at the skill of hitchhiking, reaching Ushuaia feels like a real achievement. It's like I've jumped a series of hurdles and successfully reached the finish line. Now, obviously the achievement is significantly diminished by the fact that the majority of these hurdles were self-made, and really all I had to do was sit in the passenger seat of some trucks, but I'm brainwashing myself into thinking it is an achievement. The last thing I still need to come to terms with, though, is the lingering sense of pain about not being here for the World Cup. Being in Argentina now and speaking to people about their joy makes the feeling of FOMO much worse. I mean, I am happy for them, but also I'm a selfish prick and I want a little bit of what they're having. I fly back to Buenos Aires and I drop Marcela Mora y Araujo a text. She's one of Argentina's great football writers, and listening to her speak about the 2022 World Cup is either going to make me feel way, way better or way, way worse.
This was really a social phenomenon. I mean, it was so, so incredible. And, well, 78 was amazing. And I'm old enough to remember it clearly. And it really was just joy, pure joy in the streets after a time where you weren't allowed to congregate in the street at all because right. the military dictatorship had these, you know, laws about gatherings of more than three people or whatever, and they stopped for the World Cup. So it was a real liberation in a way, just from the point of view of the lived experience of street life. It really changed it much more than this time around, but. What was amazing this last World Cup, 2022, and I don't think people around the world have quite understood the importance of this, is that it was summer here. Mm. Every other World Cup, it's been winter. Mm. And so about three games into, well, you know, after the first couple of games in the group stages, people here started to comment on how lovely it was to see everyone in the parks and just wearing the football shirts, because usually you've got a coat on top or whatever.
Sure.
So suddenly there was this sea of blue and white shirts everywhere, all the children. It's the first games were still just the end of school year, but then it was holiday. Mm. And that festive atmosphere. I mean, someone said on Twitter, it's amazing to see all these people in the parks and just in the sunshine. And I was like, oh, that's what it's like in Europe every World Cup.
Yeah.
And that kind of a couple of tweets took off with, people going, oh, I've just realised that, you know, aha. And someone going, oh, so that's why the Europeans are all so pissed off about this World Cup, because it's really cold and boring. But I think that made a massive difference, especially after the final, and there were just like two epic moments. One was the day Argentina won, where the match was played here at about midday, so there were still hours of sunshine left, and then the day the players got back. And those 2 days were just unbelievable, with the scorching sun and the heat and the big screens in the parks and all that. And so that was significantly different to 78 and 86.
Argentina is not in a great place economically. This is March 2023 and inflation rates are over 100%. Come December 2023, inflation will reach 211%. There is a wave of people who drop below the poverty line every single day, and there's evidence of it in most neighbourhoods of Buenos Aires. The bleak irony is that there couldn't be a better time to visit the country as a tourist. The exchange rate from dollar, euros or pound sterling is extremely good. But the black market is even better. You can walk down several streets to find people who will offer you what is known as the blue dollar rate.
Para mí aprovecharon que habrán nosotros y dijeron, bueno, vamos a mezclar todo.
Gracias.
I exchange my dollars in this way at first, before realizing there are more straightforward, legitimate ways of doing this. Western Union, for example, gives you double the official rate, and most card transactions are done on the blue dollar rate as well. Basically, Argentina is desperate to get rid of its own peso in exchange for your currency. As a result, it's not uncommon to see broke backpackers dining at the likes of Don Julio, one of the finest steakhouses in the world.
Do you sense a lingering sense of happiness as a result of a World Cup like that, or do you walk around the country and see everything return to a state of normalcy, which isn't, if it's fair to say, at its happiest place right now when we talk about the national identity of Argentina?
I think it's really important to separate the reality from football.
Sure.
It's not real. It's not, the emotions are real, and so the joy is real.
Sure.
And for a long time you could sense people were happier, and still now if you say, you know, I went to a couple of birthday events this weekend, and a lot of people who I haven't seen since the World Cup would just greet you with, "We won the World Cup."
Yeah.
Let's say, instead of hello, you go, "Hey, we won the World Cup," and you relive, and that's genuine. And certainly for most of January that lasted palpably, that well-being. But I think not even on the day itself did anyone actually feel that their lives were going to be significantly improved. One thing that I really like to kind of mention, because I think it's so funny but also so poignant, is just before the World Cup, my brother and some mates started to kind of do this ad hoc poll and just ask random people, you know, serving them in a restaurant or down the street, or what would you rather, political stability and the economy doing well or winning the World Cup? And I love the logic of some of the answers, because people go, well, political stability, how long can that last? The World Cup's forever.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of that's played out. You know, people are happy about the World Cup without necessarily being frustrated that nothing's ultimately changed for them. I don't think anyone expected that. There is such a thing as well-being and feeling happy. You know, some people go, why are you happy when your team wins? You don't win anything. And the kind of the line of thought that says, well, material gain isn't the only positive, you know, feeling good is really substantially important. If my team wins, I feel happy, I'm contented. Contentment is massive. And so I think that's possibly worth thinking about. You know, are some people more tuned into seeking emotional well-being than material prosperity? And when you take societies like this one, where there's an obscene number of people living below the poverty line and in kind of materially unacceptable conditions, that joy that they derive from winning at football feels kind of odd. You know, why are you so happy? Look at this terrible reality around you. But it's undeniable that they do derive that joy. You know, the celebrations, most of the images were focused around, you know, central Buenos Aires and the obelisk and so on. But actually, the outpouring of people was nationwide in every, you know, small towns, dirt roads, rural communities. That joy is for everyone, and that I think is really important. And you do have to place some value on that achievement, that the importance of giving, but of people deriving some sort of worth, sense of worth and joy from things that don't palpably change their daily reality. It's interesting. I mean, I always remember the line that said, saying we won after your team's won a football game is like saying I had sex after watching porn. And you tend not to do that with porn. But I think I won the World Cup is true in a sense, because there's a level at which every emotion that football awakens or triggers is real, and it's always related to memories of past games, your relationship with people you love, the important, you know, whatever, fathers, sons, mothers, daughters, increasingly visibly, it's always been the case. But and that, you know, the love of football is also the love of that. Of, you know, I mean, I was just telling you about 1978, and really it's entirely about my father. That's what I'm thinking about.
Era más blanda que el agua, que el agua blanda. Era más fresca que el río.
Now, after the game against Holland, everybody was talking about why must we suffer so much? The suffering must stop. And then Messi made a statement saying, well, you know, we've done well, we've known how to suffer, which is a line from a tango. You know, you have to learn to suffer and then to love.
Primero hay que saber sufrir. Después amar, después partir y al fin andar sin pensamiento.
So that kind of super embellished, romantic, you know, Argentinian approach to the game was really literal throughout the tournament. People say, yeah, that's because we needed to feel good. We all needed a bit of happiness. We all wanted to celebrate. And you know, the fact that it wasn't a protest, there's a nice piece someone did comparing the number of people out into the streets for various historical moments in Argentina. And I think Eva Perón's death kind of tops the charts still, and compared to relative to population at the time. And what things have brought the most people out into the streets? And 2022 isn't even that. I mean, it's a lot, but it's like other sporting event celebrations, where protests and mourning, all you know. So there's the negative and the positive outpour of people onto the streets, and the positive is really memorable because also it's rarer.
después, ¿qué importa del después? Toda mi vida es el ayer que me detiene en el pasado. Eterna y vieja juventud que me ha dejado acobardado como un pájaro sin luz.
There's no getting away from the World Cup. At a wine bar where football doesn't appear to be a factor, Muchachos eventually rings out. Fred again and Skrillex are playing together at a hall in the city. Muchachos rings out there as well. I need to tell you about my accommodation here in Buenos Aires. If you listened to episode 3 of this series, when we brought you to Bolivia, you'll be aware of Paul, one of my good friends who I've made on this trip. Now he's got a friend, also called Paul, who is landing in Buenos Aires the same weekend I'm back in the city. They're both from Tipperary. This second Paul has not made the desperately irresponsible decision to leave his life behind and travel the world. And Paul's career is going pretty well. At least, that's what I take from the fact that he's a full-blown member of Marriott Hotels. This is a world with which I am not fully familiar, but if there are Level Cities memberships, then it's the one where you get a big suite and access to the lounge with all the free food. I've been travelling at this point for over 6 months. I have predominantly stayed in hostel dorms. As recently as last week, I slept on a mattress on a kitchen floor in a shack in Patagonia. But when I land back in Buenos Aires, I'm told there's room for me in the Marriott right beside the Obelisco in the middle of the city. It might be the happiest moment of my life. The warm, powerful shower, the massive bed, the fresh fruit and the vegetables, and the volume of food, breakfast, lunch, dinner, on repeat, unlimited refills on the plate. These are not the circles I normally operate in. Everyone who is in this Marriott lounge is extremely rich. Needless to say, I am not extremely rich. In fact, given I have spent most of the last year not working and devouring my savings, I wonder to myself, am I the poorest person who has ever had guest access to this lounge? It's also the sort of lounge where names and room numbers aren't exactly asked for. This is an exclusive club, and to ask rich people such things would be deeply offensive. But the staff take one look at me in my road-worn clothes and presume I've got no right to be here. Could I get your room number, sir? They seem astonished when the information adds up. After a few days at the hotel, we notice a change in tone. There appears to be more staff at the hotel, and they've started dressing a touch smarter. The men are all now wearing blue ties. At first, we pay little attention. And then we realise what's happening in town over the next couple of days. It is Argentina's second World Cup homecoming. Their first home game since winning in Qatar a few months previously. We get chatting to the staff and they're coy about what's in the pipeline. What's going on here? We ask. A cheeky wink from the porter. Is the team staying in this hotel? A smirk. Wow. Maybe the universe has finally given me an answer. Maybe I had to go through the agony of missing out on the biggest party in the history of humankind in Buenos Aires last December. All I had to do was wait until March, and I would finally get my moment in this elongated World Cup celebration extravaganza. I might actually bump into Lionel Messi in the lift. Lionel Scaloni will surely be in the same queue for the toast machine at the breakfast buffet. Panama are the team who have come to Buenos Aires to be the cannon fodder for this Argentinian celebration. They're playing one another at El Monumental, the River Plate Stadium, and tickets are impossible to come by. After a luckless search for tickets, we settle for watching the celebrations and the game in the Marriott. Argentina beat Panama 2-0. A couple of hours after the game, we notice from our balcony a bus driving down Avenida Nueve de Julio. It's coming with a police escort. It gets to the Obelisco and turns down our side of the street. And it stops at the Marriott. The doors to the bus open, and the players start filtering out into this hotel. We sprint downstairs to the lobby, and there they are, the players, walking right towards us. But there's been some sort of misunderstanding. Yes, the players from the game tonight are in this hotel, and here they come. But they are the Panama players. Gutting. We get a photo with one of them, and he lets us hold his boots for a moment. The press officer of the team is standing nearby, which is handy, and he tells us that the player is Jorge Luis Serrano. I Google it to see how many minutes Serrano and his boots spent on the same pitch as Messi tonight. Jorge Luis Serrano was an unused substitute. It's a Sunday afternoon, which means the San Telmo market is buzzing. It's prime people watching real estate. There will be tango on the streets. Old copies of El Grafico are available to buy on many of the stalls if you're a total football nerd. And there are many more suspect things of note available for purchase.
What the fuck?
What is it?
It's birthday stamps.
Oh, right.
But these Argentinians have obviously kept in memory of Hitler.
Yeah, crazy.
Fucking hell.
I pop the head into a bar where a man is running around topless. Napoli are beating Empoli 3-0, and they're on track to win their first Scudetto since 1990, i.e. their first since Diego Maradona played for them. Groups of porteños meet up in various places around the city every weekend to watch Napoli. These are absolutely maniacal supporters of a team over 11,000 kilometres away from here, one of the many elements of Maradona's legacy. Walk half an hour south and you're in La Boca. Where you'll see Maradona present in murals, flags, jerseys, dolls, tea cozies, keyrings, and anything that you can put the image of a face onto. There is a model of Maradona waving from a balcony of a house beside the stadium. And in another balcony stands a model of Pope Francis. Maradona is Jesus Christ everywhere in this country, but the people of La Boca are his greatest disciples. And it's important to say that it is La Boca, not just the stadium La Bombonera. It is the buildings nearby, the walls nearby, everything in this neighbourhood painted blue and gold. It could so easily be black and white. The story goes that their local rivals in the early 20th century were Nottingham de Almagro, and both sides wore similar white and black colours. The teams agreed to a playoff, and the loser would have to change their colours forever. Boca were beaten, and they decided to follow the colours of the first ship that arrived in the port of Buenos Aires. And in sailed a ship carrying a Swedish flag. The streets of La Boca on match day are magic. Fernet and Coke comes out of the street stalls by the double pint. A customary rendition of Muchachos. And then into La Bombonera to watch Boca Juniors face Instituto of Córdoba, the club with which Mario Kempes started his senior career. This is a stadium that carries the proud Irish tradition of basically only having three sides to it. Jumpers are tied into the fence in front of us, behind one of the goals. It's done by parents to keep a spot for their kids who stand and hold onto the fence throughout the game. Boca, it's fair to say, are not very good. 2-0 down after 20 minutes. They do manage to pull one back right before half-time. Within a minute of the restart, Instituto are 3-1 ahead. Boca bring it back to 3-2 in the 85th minute. It would be nothing more than a consolation. Boca Juniors may not be great, but their fans, their stadium and everything around it, well, believe the hype. But there is another club on my radar. If this was Love Island and I was in the business of being wooed by an Argentinian club, I'd be telling Boca Juniors that I'm keeping my options open. By this stage, you're well familiar with my World Cup bottle job. You may remember that I had specific plans to watch some of the 2022 World Cup not only in Buenos Aires, but also in Rosario, the hometown of Lionel Messi. And this story of what could have been, I feel it is only right to travel to Rosario. And I've got double the reason to go when friends of mine from this trip are also going to check out football in the city. You'll have heard me mention an English couple called Stan and Libby already in this series. I have third-wheeled them to the point where we are now basically in a situationship. The situation being, if they're in an Airbnb with a spare sofa bed, they will drop a text and everyone can save a bit of money. I should state they are genuinely excellent company, and Stan has wanted to come to Rosario for quite some time now. Specifically, he's wanted to go and see a Newell's Old Boys game, because one of their club legends is Marcelo Bielsa, and Stan is a massive Leeds United fan. We've arranged to meet Nicolas, a season ticket holder with Newell's Old Boys.
Nice to meet you.
How are you doing?
Hola.
¿Cómo se
llamas?
Nicolas.
Tonight they're playing San Lorenzo at home, and so we head for Marcelo Bielsa Stadium. Oh,
shit. Marcelo Bielsa. Sí. He lives round the corner.
Oh, really?
No way.
Yeah. Really?
But he's not in Rosario, right? He's in Brazil. He has a big ranch, 1 hour, for example, from Rosario. So he's in Rosario, Montevideo, his ranch, and Brazil.
I was hoping I might just bump into him.
There is the mildly inconvenient kickoff time of 6:30 on a Monday evening for fans to deal with.
This is Monday at 6:30 is difficult as well, right?
For everyone, the idea is to go to 2 hours in advance, have a drink, eat something there, enjoy the atmosphere. But today, everyone is going to get to the stadium 10 minutes before.
Yeah. Why so early?
Argentina, man.
Away fans are not allowed to attend league matches in Argentina.
What happened?
No away fans.
Violence.
Yeah, was there a particular flashpoint?
No. It was like a snowball.
Yeah.
Snowball, and someone said, no, not anymore. But this is Argentina, and some games you have away fans.
Oh, really?
If the fans are not violent and the stadium is big, maybe police allow. We are like high risk.
you're dangerous
fans.
People.
Yeah, we are dangerous people. So it's very difficult for us to travel.
It's like Leeds fans.
But the Argentina, Copa Argentina, is the equivalent to the FA Cup. We play in neutral stadium, and both fans are allowed. So why we can play with both fans in Copa Argentina and not in the league?
Just doesn't matter as much, obviously.
No one can answer that.
Newell's are the better team on the night and deservedly find their winner in the 77th minute, thanks to Jorge Eduardo Recalde. They win 1-0.
Hola, Kichi. Sí, sí. ¿Cómo estás? ¿Cómo estás? Es mi amigo Stan.
The next morning, we're back in the stadium to meet Armando Garrido, affectionately known as Kichi.
¿Qué pasa, Carmen?
Hola, ¿no?
¿Cómo estás?
Bien.
Soy con estos muchachos que son de Irlanda.
¡Ah! ¿Irlandés?
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Muy bien, muy bien.
Vamos a tomar un cafecito.
¡Listo!
Gracias,
mucho gusto.
Bienvenido.
Kitchy was left back on the famous Newell's team of 1974 when the club won their first title.
Bueno, ese equipo 74, 88, 1988, 90, 91, 92, 2004 y 2003. Mhm. Esas son todas las estrellas que tiene yo.
His is a beloved team with the number 74 painted into the seats and a mural in the stadium depicting the squad. Kitchy is here to show us around the stadium, and when we sit in the stands for a chat, there are talking points all around us. On one of the stands, the name Tato Martino was written. He holds the record for the most appearances for the club. He managed the club to a title in 2013 before going on to briefly manage Barcelona. And he has also managed Lionel Messi's Inter Miami.
Aquí miro a Maxi Rodriguez.
A stand is also named after Maxi Rodriguez.
Bueno, la historia de Maxi, específicamente. Vos me preguntás por él.
I'm delighted to say here that the person voicing Kichi for us in English is Fabian Costello. Fabian played for Newell's Old Boys and is now living in Dublin. He's also a Copa Libertadores champion with Uruguay's Peñarol.
Es uno de lo que nosotros llamamos identidad y pertenencia.
Max's story actually is one of those that we call identity and belonging. Being at Liverpool with a huge contract in terms of money he earned, he decided to, at the age of 32, return to his beloved club and stay here for 8 years and also become champion.
Y además salir campeón, también cumplió su sueño, ¿no?
He had fulfilled his dreams, and not only him, but also many other players like our current coach, Heinze.
That's Gabriel Heinze of Manchester United and Real Madrid fame. He will leave his job here after a year at the club and has yet to get back into football management.
Who had the option to work at any club. He decided to be a Newell's boy for the love or our club.
Pero bueno, él decidió por amor a nuestro club estar en Newell.
There's a stand named after Diego Maradona.
Bueno, Diego no jugó mucho acá, pero él siempre habló muy bien de Newell.
Diego didn't play much here, but he always spoke very highly of Newell's Boys. Always say that the national soccer is called Newell's Boys. That's one of his words. Football is called Newell's Boys.
Y el fútbol se llama Newell's Boys. Lo dice por todos los jugadores que pasaron por nuestro club. Que
he says it for all the players who passed through the club and who are famous all over the world, and the managers. The likes
Marcelo Bielsa,
Marcelo Bielsa,
de Mauricio Pochettino,
Mauricio Pochettino, Tata Martino.
Así que bueno, Diego en ese momento decide jugar acá porque bueno.
So Diego at the moment decided to play here because well, he fell in love. He fell in love with Newell's Boys, and those who came here fall in love with the club, and they always come back.
Los que vienen acá se enamoran del club y siempre vuelven.
Newell's Old Boys was Maradona's first club after he returned from Europe. His first appearance for the club came in a friendly against Ecuadorian side Emelec, in which he scored his only goal for the club.
Diego, 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 Diego! De pie! De pie, señores, de pie. Es el fútbol, es Maradona, es el gol, es el grito, es el reencuentro del ídolo con el fútbol y con el genio. Maradona frota la lámpara. Maradona hace gritar a todo el país. Maradona 1, Emelec 0.
A 6-year-old Lionel Messi watches on in the crowd. And there's good footage online of Maradona's competitive debut a few days later against Independiente. His homecoming is being lapped up by the commentators, repeatedly referring to him as El Maestro.
La intercepción fue de Cassini. El maestro. Cassini. Otra vez el maestro. Sigue el maestro. Grande maestro. El centro maestro. Salvamos.
when he ships a heavy tackle, the commentator asks, "How is the genius?"
Comanda genio.
And another attempt to tackle him is met with, "Don't mess with Diego."
Vamos y luego. Perico lo empujaste, querido. No te metas con Diego.
Maradona tries two rabonas in the match.
La última vez que tuvo cuando antes de que falleciera él.
The last time he was here before he died, he paid tribute to him here on the field. He cried his emotional words. He'd always had a brotherly and eternal love for News Old Boys.
Siempre tuvo un amor fraternal y eterno hacia News Old Boys.
And it was a brilliant tribute.
Rosario, la ciudad de Río, el Parque de la Independencia, lo tiene Diego. Una vez más aquí.
Paintings and framed jerseys were presented to him on the pitch before a game. He was here as manager of Gimnasia in 2019. Newell's also presented to him a red and black throne with the Newell's logo and his number painted on it. He managed his team to a 4-0 win from the comfort of that throne. Newell's have the fortune of looking back on that 2019 moment as being able to pay tribute to Maradona while he was still with us.
Trincao. Messi just dancing around. Messi drives to the 18. Messi parks it in the back of the net.
From another son of Newell's Old Boys, the most poignant tribute came after Maradona's death. In Barcelona's first game after he passed away, Lionel Messi scores this goal that fittingly is a sort of mirror image of the one that Maradona scored for Newell's against Emelec in 1993. We all wondered how Messi would pay tribute to Maradona. The Barcelona and Argentina parallels are so obvious.
And here is the wonderful tribute to the number 10 of yesteryear.
But instead, he takes off his Barcelona top to reveal that amazing 1993-94 Newell's jersey, the one with Yamaha on the front and number 10 on the back. It was a jersey that Maradona had actually worn in one of his few appearances for the club.
The man who closed his career at Newell's, and that is an original Diego Maradona Newell's jersey.
Queré una imagen más importante que esa. Esa recorrió el mundo. Esa la vieron 4.000, 5.000 millones de personas en el mundo.
Kichi is saying here that Messi created an image that travelled the world. 4 or 5 billion people in the world saw that image. And for Newell's, he says, it was a demonstration of a lot of love.
Sometimes what he implies is better than whatever he can say. You see, Messi is not a boy who likes to talk, but he demonstrates his love for the Lord with actions.
Demuestra él ese amor que tenía por este Diego y Diego también ese amor que tenía por él.
He shows the love he had for Diego, and Diego also had for the same love for him, because they are two unrepeatable phenomena. Another player like them is not going to come.
On YouTube, you can watch Messi as a 12-year-old play for Newell's. There are moments of magic, and there are more simple things, such as the fact that he stands with the same gait as he does now. If you wanted an inkling of how serious even underage football is taken around here, listen to this commentator.
Grigin entrega para Messi. Messi otra vez para Ecuador. Jiménez para Messi. Atención, viene el remate de Messi. Pelota queda en el cuerpo de Segovia. Atino otra vez el 10, que ya jugó rápido para Ecuador. Jiménez, viene toque para Messi. ¡Gol! ¡Gol! ¡De Newell!
Bueno, Messi jugaba en un club, barrio.
Messi played in the neighborhood club, and then he came to play News Old Boys. In 176 games playing News Old Boys, he scored 234 goals, something incredible, and an average of 1.5 goals per match.
Un gol y medio, casi dos goles por partido.
My admiration for Marcelo Bielsa is huge, because he made the players better. Better, no, much, much, much better. That's why for me it's the best coach in the world.
Aquí es, el nombre es Marcelo Bielsa. So
el estadio es Marcelo Bielsa. Cuando le pusieron en el año 2009.
The name, the stadium after him in 2009. We love him very much. We love him for what he represents. Marcelo is not just football.
Porque es un maestro brillante. Y bueno, eso para nosotros es un orgullo.
He's a brilliant teacher, and that is a tremendous source of pride for us. When he goes to a club, he doesn't fix, he transforms it. And when he goes to a club, What he does is change absolutely everything. He produces a transformation. He produces a change at club level, at management level, at every level. It's everything he does.
Es el único técnico en el mundo que tiene tanto seguidor y tanto hincha, ¿no?
He's the coach who has many followers and fans. It's rare to have fans when you are a coach. He's a genius. He's a different person.
I asked Kichi what makes the football culture here in Rosario so special.
Es muy difícil explicar porque el tema es cómo explicas la pasión.
And he says it's very difficult to explain because the issue is how do you explain passion? What is passion? It's like the believer. What is faith if you don't feel it? I don't know what faith is. It's something abstract, and passion is the same. For someone who likes football, passion surpasses reason of the heart. The heart does not understand.
La razón del corazón que el corazón no comprende. Es tan hermoso porque es muy difícil vivir sin pasión.
It's so beautiful because it's very difficult to live without passion. It is not easy to explain what passion is. It is felt here in the soul and nothing else. Winning is like success. It's like ecstasy. It would be seeing the club that you love so much win. It's like it's the most wonderful thing I can tell you about.
Es lo más maravilloso que te puedo hablar. Yo digo siempre que yo tengo los grandes amores míos.
I always said that I have great loves. There are my three children, my two grandchildren, brothers, parents, and Newell's is also in there, more or less the same.
Y está Newell, ahí, más o menos igual.
Es una familia.
Es como una familia, sí. Exactamente.
Rosario in the books, Buenos Aires in the books. The right places at the wrong time. When I got on that plane in 2022, I had one job. Get myself to Argentina for the World Cup. Even if it was a group stage exit for Argentina, I knew that I needed to get a sense of what it was like here. I don't really remember the moment in my life when I decided that I really wanted to go to Argentina and that being there for a World Cup would be on my bucket list. Anyway, it's still there, still firmly on the list. Incomplete. Mission failed. Who knows if the chance will ever arise again. Honestly, it still brings pangs of regret every time I see videos of the homecoming. The problem is that I've literally spoken so much about how that moment crushes me that my social media algorithm actually feeds me content from that exact moment. It's a vicious cycle. Some final thoughts from Marcela Mora Iarabo.
It doesn't wear off. I think people, if you bring the World Cup as a topic, people will regain the smile and the joy. It just becomes lesser, as a close to the surface emotion when you know normal life resumes, which it did very quickly, by the way. You know, it's not like people were in a stupor and just lying there thinking about Messi, doing nothing else for long. Like within a day, you could just go into a shop or whatever. It's maybe a far-fetched comparison, but I thought about the Queen dying and the queue, and this was the opposite of the queue.
Yeah. There's definitely no queue.
And you know, there's no bracelet to go to the loo, yeah. No usher, no nothing. I mean, there were lots of people that just took makeshift grills and started selling, you know, chorizos. But there was no... it's always possible to just go a little bit to another corner. You know, in London, you could actually go look the other way and everything was completely normal and there were plenty of people not partaking in the mandated morning. This was incredibly genuine and spontaneous and there was and it was chaotic and then also it just stopped quite naturally, you know, then at the end of the day, people, I mean, obviously there were some incidents and whatever, but literally no more than an average football game. Mm. It's like a whole country became a stadium for a minute.
Yeah.
And then the stands were like stretched out into motorways or whatever. And then it just, the games, you know, it was full time and the whistle blew.
And then she brings me back to 1986, Argentina's last World Cup title before 2022.
I set off as a young backpacker, hoping to go by land from Rio, really, or Brazil, the kind of southern Brazil, to Mexico. And the intention was, I set off in February, the idea was to get to Mexico for the World Cup in June. And halfway there, like time-wise and space-wise, I realised it was such a tall order. I hadn't quite fathomed that the distances are huge, but also the logistics of moving around South and Central America, I hadn't quite reckoned. There's like massive jungle and, you know, you can't just walk like along the sandy beaches all the way up there. So I ended up spending the entire World Cup in Brazil, and of course it was a World Cup that Brazil did bad, well, they didn't do so badly, but for the Brazilian ego at that time, it was, you know, shameful. They were defeated by France, and then Argentina, in fact, the worst night was when Argentina beat England, and the infamous two goals. The Brazilians were absolutely livid that the first hand goal was allowed.
Really?
And we were in a small town where we had to kind of run out of a bar through the back because the barman said, if you guys are Argentinian, they're going to kill you.
Wow.
So it was completely epic. And then the final was really sad because I was in a hostel in Rio and I watched it with some German guys who couldn't believe the lack of celebratory mood, and they took me out for a beer. So I swore I would never watch a final away from Argentinian soil again. And the reason why I think you say I've cheered you up is because I said to you, and I got 40 years of story out of it. I never thought I'd literally make a living out of shaping that terrible loneliness in different ways. So even this World Cup, when I managed to wangle an invite to Qatar for a couple of games, I requested to fly back to be here for the final, and people go, you didn't stay for the final in Qatar, and I'm like, no way, you know. After what happened in 1986, I'm not watching a final outside Argentina ever again.
Marcela, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Good luck on your travels. I hope you can milk missing out on the World Cup as much as I managed with 86.
I remember crystal clear the details of what happened in that World Cup final. I also remember crystal clear the details of that day, hanging around a hostel in North Colombia, trying to come to terms with what had happened that morning. I remember the sun setting over the Burataca River, close to the Caribbean. And I specifically remember the song Want You in My Soul by Lovebirds playing on the speakers at that precise moment as the night was about to get going. And I remember saying that I need to get over myself because this night is going to be better than whatever is happening in Argentina right now. Obviously, that was a complete lie. But I did take Marcela's advice and milked it for all it was worth. That's why you've just finished listening to a 10-part documentary series. Had I been in Argentina for the biggest party in the history of humankind, I probably wouldn't have gone hitchhiking in Patagonia. I probably wouldn't have gone to that fighting festival in Bolivia, and I definitely wouldn't have had those 2 minutes and 58 seconds of dreaming in Costa Rica. And maybe this series would have been way more boring. Or maybe it would have been way better, let's be honest. This has often felt like an audio project where I just moan about an overbearing sense of FOMO, when actually it's been a series full of moments I never would have had if it wasn't for missing out. I know you're here for me and I will always want you in my soul. I want you in my soul, said I want you in my soul. You love to me, it's gold. You love to me, it's gold. Thing I can't control, stay.
control. Think I can't let this feeling go. Don't let the feeling go. Don't let the feeling go. Want you in my soul.
This has been the final episode of Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball, produced by me, Owen Shahan. My handle across social media platforms is Owen Shahan, as all one word, and there's video content across those platforms to accompany this podcast. A big thank you to Fabian Costello for helping me out with introductions to people at Newell's Old Boys for this episode, and also to the hospitable folk of the St. David Association in Tralee for dealing with my unannounced arrival. This is the end of this series, but your positive ratings continue to be so appreciated, and I'm hoping that there's not really a shelf life on this, and hopefully it continues to find new ears well into the future. Honestly, I've got no idea where or when the next adventure will happen, or if it will happen. I'm still just relieved I got driven down to the end of the world in one piece. Thanks a million for listening.